This month we're reading Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? Philip K. Dick's seminal sci-fi novel that would go on to inspire the movie Blade Runner. As usual, there aren't any spoilers in this episode, but there are a couple of Dick jokes. I mean, like, can you even blame us? So if you're at work, you might pop on some headphones. Otherwise, let's get this party started. Hi, this is Maria Blackheart, and welcome to the Misfit Book Club, a podcast for readers, robots, replicants, weirdos, blue stockings, normals, scribbling women, and every type of bookish person in between. This is episode 15, and I'm here with my co-host, Pixie Berger.
Hey, Maria, and hey, Misfits.
Hey, Pixie, how are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
I'm doing really good because I have a slinket.
Glory.
For those of you who don't know what a slinket is, one, it can only be purchased from like QVC at 2 a.m., which is what my mother did for me. So that's pretty exciting.
So sweet.
It is like a better version of a Snuggie. So you don't like zip into it. It's just a blanket, only it has sleeves that you can stick your hands through and like a hoodie pocket in front that you can subsequently put your hands into, and then a little pocket for your feet on the bottom. So like, it's literally the best thing to have if you're reading, because your arms stay warm but you're still under a super cozy blanket, and like the only thing sticking out is your head like a little turtle, and it's so great.
That sounds amazing. And I must admit, I was under the wrong impression that basically a slanket and a Snuggie were the same.
Snuggies are like constricting. Also, I feel like it is the next step on my journey to become a 90-year-old woman.
I have a slanket as well, or it's like an off-brand slanket that my grandmother gave me. So that sounds about right.
Yeah, I'm ready for the nursing home. Let's go.
Sign me up. Oh my gosh. As long as I don't have to work anymore. If I can just do what I want and I can retire today, I'm happy.
I'll eat Jell-O pudding and soft foods for the rest of my life if that's the only price I have to pay.
Oh my word. So I have to tell you this. I was on Reddit the other day, what? Which... I know you like Reddit a lot, so I don't get on Reddit very much because to me it represents like the best and the worst of humanity, right? And I tend to come across the worst usually. But if you have not checked out the book thread on Reddit, you guys, it is just a delightful place. So much good stuff happening there. So I was just poking around and I happened to come across this question or comment, I guess, that for some reason just struck me as so amazing. All right, the comment is from someone named Vhite, V-H-I-T-E. Okay, so here's what the comment says. The title of the beginning of the thread is, "Sometimes I worry that my favorite book might not be all that great." He or she continues, "And I know it's rather childish, but it's not about what other people think, though I'd be lying if I said that I'm completely immune to that feeling. Someone might take my favorite book, give it a careful consideration, and then still dismiss it. And I would still be fine with that since people have different tastes. My worry is that my own taste isn't yet done evolving and that I might become that person myself and that I might lose all the emotional and intellectual investment I've put into that book. To be a little more specific about my insecurity, my favorite book, or series rather, is Spice and Wolf. It's certainly no literary classic. It's rarely talked about outside of its fan base, and most people still know the name mainly from the anime adaption. Yet examining the story with a cool head, even months after I finished it, I can't help but to see it as the most captivating story I've ever encountered. I'm not really sure where I'm going this. Do you have such worries? Is it reasonable to worry to have, or should I just get over it and trust my judgment?" I just love that comment so much because it's like, on one level, a completely ridiculous thing to worry about, but then on a second level, like, I get it. Just all the like self-doubt and just this fear that like you're changing but the book stays the same, and then what happens, and then those feelings, are they real or are they fake? Like, it is just an anxious person's comment, and I guess that's why I love it so much.
As you were reading that, I was like, yeah, I get that. Like, I'm really afraid to reread the books I loved from my childhood, because what if I go back and it's like, oh, these are bad. And then somehow it like sullies the memory of the book that I love so much. I don't know.
I don't either. And I guess I'm laughing because I haven't ever had that experience where I read something and was like, oh, this is awful. Like, I've read things and been like, I've grown, but I don't feel like something huge has been lost. But I totally get why that person feels that way.
It's an identity crisis.
Yeah. And it just speaks to how we, the relationship between the book and the reader, right? Like, we change. Every book you read changes us. The book doesn't change. Like, the words are still what they are, but you can be the same person and come back to it, and it can mean something different to you a second time or a third time. And it is really kind of a magical dynamic.
Mm-hmm. I feel that way with a lot of my favorites that are also classics. So Jane Eyre, I've probably read 8, 9, 10 times.
Wow.
And every time I go back, I'm in love with it for a different reason. I don't know. I am a big rereader of things that I love, but I haven't gone back and reread some of the stuff I really, really liked from my childhood, I guess.
I can't say that I've read anything 8 or 9 times.
Like, it's just sort of accumulated over time, but I really, really love Jane Eyre. When you teach, though, you reread crap all the time. Like, it's incalculable how many times I've read Heart of Darkness at this point, and I don't even like it.
Just out of necessity. Well, I love this commenter, whoever you are. I love that you basically think about your books like relationships. Anyway, I just thought I would share it. Also, we hadn't ever talked about the bookstart on Reddit, and I love it. So
yes,
go find it, guys. There's something there for you.
Thanks for sharing that, Pixie. I loved it.
Book news this week. There was a study that came out a few days ago from a bunch of academic folks, which is what Maria and I are. So we tend to nerd out over certain things. But some people from the universities of Illinois and California at Berkeley, and this came from The Guardian, by the way. It was reported pretty wildly, but this is where I was getting some of this verbiage. They used an algorithm to examine 104,000 works of fiction dating from 1780 to 2007. And what they were doing with this algorithm was they were trying to figure out things about who was writing, what kind of characters they were writing, and what sort of sex and gender situation was happening with literature. Like, were more women writing, were fewer? Were they writing more female characters or fewer? So basically, they found that from the 19th century through the early 1960s, this is a quote, we see a story of steady decline, meaning the number of women characters dropped in literature. Hmm. They also found, quote, a fairly stunning decline, end quote, in the number of books written by women in the first half of the 20th century, writing that the proportion of fiction actually written by women drops by half, from roughly 50% of titles to roughly 25% as we move from 1850 to 1950.
Wow.
Which actually, like, I would have guessed that to be.
Really?
I would have, yeah, just because it seems like the 19th century was full of women novelists.
That's
who were
true.
Very, very commercially successful. But then something kind of took a turn and modernism was not a woman genre. Like, women did write during that time period, but that's not what we see in our literature classes, right? Those are not the writers that we focus on. It was almost like they were written out of the narrative.
Well, it started making money.
Yeah.
I felt very, very vindicated because I was like, yeah, my century rocks. The rest of this stuff is sucky. But you know, that's not really a good hill to die on.
Well, the 19th century, like I said, was full of women novelists who made a lot of money, kind of like today. But those books are not the ones that you read when you take a survey class.
Mm-mm.
You read Melville and Hawthorne and Poe.
Well, and most of those books are out of print.
Yeah, some small presses have been trying to kind of give new life to these old women's novels just because they disappeared basically from record, even though a lot of people were reading them back in the day. And so I'm grateful for those people, obviously, because they've made them more accessible to us. But it doesn't give you a very clear representation during that time. Like, I didn't read Uncle Tom's Cabin, even though that was the most famous book in arguably in American history.
I would say that I didn't even get it in grad school because you read kind of the heavy hitters. So some George Eliot, some Charlotte Bronte. You might read Emily Bronte, Mary Shelley. Other than that, it's like, whoops, there weren't any other women writing, but there certainly were. Like, there were a bunch of them, and they were good, too.
Mm-hmm. And this is true today. Marie and I talk about it all the time. Things that are popular sometimes don't make it into the canon just because people don't think it's high quality enough. There's a lot of conversation to be had about what constitutes high quality versus low mm-hmm. quality, what people think deserves to be literature and what doesn't. And it just tends to be the course of things that women's books get written out.
Yep. And Pixie and I are of the mind that if something is super popular, it's worthwhile.
Yes. Because
it is speaking to something in that moment, and it's important to figure out what that is. So that includes 50 Shades of Grey and Twilight and The Hunger Games, and it's worthy of study.
Doesn't mean you have to love it or even like it, but it's worthy. It's worthy because there's something there.
Agreed. I'm also fascinated by books that get turned into movies.
Same. Like,
why? How do we pick them? Like, like Jeff Vandermeer's Annihilation is about to become a movie, which is exciting.
Yes.
But also, I'm like, Jeff Vandermeer novels have got to be really hard to bring to screen because they are crazy. They are just insane.
Annihilation is insane. I really don't know what to expect with this movie.
Well, I don't either. That was very enlightening.
Yep. You're welcome, guys. That was good.
This is what you pay for. I will remind you, you pay nothing.
You pay $0. No one pays us anything for this quality content.
Oh, gosh. I think that's really fascinating. And I think it reminds us why it's so important to push for diversity.
Well, it brings us to an interesting point, which is that literature is in a moment, right? Mm-hmm. Things that are written in a certain time, sometimes they're perceived by the readers of the time as very out of touch or doesn't make sense or like, we don't get it. We don't understand. But then 10 years, 20 years, 100 years down the pike, people are able to look at it and understand it better, which I think is kind of true about Philip K. Dick, who we're talking about today. Somebody who was mildly successful during his life, but who was much more successful after he died. It was mm-hmm. almost as though people just did not get it until he was already gone.
He's also insane.
So you say.
Yeah, he probably wasn't. He was just a very futuristic thinker that nobody understood in his time.
No. Listen, we've talked about this before. I think that there is a connection to mental illness and brilliance. Like, there's something mm-hmm. there. And I'm not trying to glorify that at all. But I think people who think a lot tend to go places in their minds that some people don't. I'm just going to be perfectly honest. I have never read a Philip K. Dick novel before. So this is brand new for me. It's a bit out of my comfort zone for reading because I love films that are science fiction or that are post-apocalyptic, dystopian stuff. I love all of that. I haven't read a ton of it in literature, so I'm super challenged with this one, but that's what we're trying to do here.
Absolutely. When it comes to dystopian literature, I got you, girl. But thank with science you. Fiction, I'm also a little light. I'm kind of excited. We may have to make some phone calls to some people we know and be like, can you teach us about Philip K. Dick in 5 minutes or less?
Yeah, I think we can get a little bit out for our readers and listeners this week. So,
oh, yeah, for sure. So you want to introduce us to good old Phil?
Yes. By the way, people who are big fans of Dick refer to themselves as dickheads. That is true.
Big fans of Dick.
Just saying. We're grown-ups.
We're seven.
We're grown-ass ladies.
Yes, we are. And we can find dick jokes funny.
Yes, we can. Oh, man. So Philip K. Dick was an American science fiction author. He was born in Chicago, and he had a twin sister who died just weeks after they were born, which is sad, but it's also fascinating because apparently the fact that she lived was a part of his life story. Even though he didn't really know her, just the fact that she existed really impacted his worldview. He was buried next to her when he died.
Really?
Yeah. This is also another weird fact. He went to high school in California, and he went to the same high school and graduated in the same class as Ursula K. Le Guin. But they didn't know each other.
What was happening in that high school?
I don't know.
What are the chances?
Very strange. Anyway, he went to college. I don't think it went very well. So he wasn't there for long. And basically, he wrote 36 novels. Very prolific. 6 collections of short stories. Like I said, I'm extremely familiar with the adaptations of his work. He's most famous for A Scanner Darkly, which mm-hmm. he wrote, and then it was also a film. Currently, there is an Amazon show, The Man in the High Castle, which is based off of something he wrote. Minority Report, that was a short story of his that obviously is a movie. And then Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, which we're reading this month, inspired Blade Runner, which is kind of a famous postmodern film starring Maria's other boyfriend, Harrison Ford.
Yes, he's so hot. Young Harrison, all day, every day. And of course, Blade Runner just had a sequel. I guess it's a sequel that stars everyone's other boyfriend, Ryan Gosling.
Hey, girl.
Yeah. I think with Philip K. Dick's stuff, I think it would be really hard to dig in and figure out what he's actually written, because it's my understanding that it's like 121 short stories.
That's a lot.
And then his novels are all over the place. Mm-hmm. Like, some of them are real, sort of accessible, and others are just out there.
Yeah.
Partly, especially his later stuff, because I think whatever personal problems he was going through started to affect his writing pretty strongly.
He had some bouts with drugs. I think he tried to commit suicide at least once, maybe more.
Yeah, and toward the end of his life, he began experiencing hallucinations. Like, these were really significant hallucinations. For example, he believed that he was living two parallel lives simultaneously, one as Philip and another as a man named Thomas. And in 1982, the year he died, he actually wrote a book about it. And he also had some weird fascination / obsession with religion. So some of his hallucinations were about meeting Jesus in Rome. And at one point, he thought he was possessed by the spirit of the prophet Elijah. And during that time, he also wrote letters to the FBI accusing people he knew of being Russian spies.
My word.
Yeah, so the wheels had started to come off the bus, like, right around 10 years before he died.
There's a lot there.
Yeah, for sure.
So by the time he died, he'd written all this stuff, but he basically had no money. And the year he died, Blade Runner came out, which that was kind of the big turning point for his work. I think people suddenly started taking notice, which is what a major motion picture will do for a lot of people. So once again, it's kind of sad that he didn't even get to see that happen. But yeah, it was just the beginning of his career, basically.
I've always sort of felt sad for writers who find huge amounts of success posthumously. Because when you're writing, like, writing is such a hard job, because oftentimes you write because you love it and don't see a ton of commercial success from it. I mean, you have big names, right? You have the John Greens of the world. But for the most part, a lot of writers have other jobs. Mm-hmm. And so when somebody becomes huge in their genre, like Philip K. Dick is, there's something kind of tragic to me about that happening after you're gone.
Absolutely. And in writing, it's such a solitary activity.
I think that's why so many writers are prolific on Twitter.
I never thought of that. That makes sense, though. That's a sort of connection for them.
So basically, now Dick is major.
Yeah, he's major. He's major at this point. It's very likely that some of you know a lot more about Philip K. Dick than we do. I'm out of my depth here. But if you have like some articles or some tips, just facts that you feel like we absolutely need to know or that we need to talk about, add us. So,
hey, that's all we know about Dick.
Yeah. So that's absolutely it. I know nothing else about Dick.
But we're willing to learn about Dick.
So I got really interested in Blade Runner because I went to this fantastic exhibit at the Victoria and Albert Museum in London about postmodernism. And Blade Runner was used as like one of the, I guess, examples of postmodernism at its peak, right? What it looks like on screen, postmodern fashion, postmodern narrative. And so that's kind of how we're probably going to look at this novel too, right? Asking some very existential questions about existence that postmodernists are just plagued by. So things like, what is life? What does that mean? What does it mean to be a human? Which obviously that sort of question probably troubled Philip K. Dick if he felt he had different parallel personalities or was in different places, or that's a very disorienting question. He even at times, from what I could tell, wondered if we existed. Just because I'm thinking that I exist, am I existing? What does that mean? Like, that is an impossible question.
Yes. And I'm speaking out of turn here, but I wonder if he was interested in kind of this idea of life being a simulation.
Yes.
Like, because he writes sci-fi, basically.
Yes.
That would make a lot of sense to me.
Yes, definitely. I think that appears. And, you know, we have all these films and stories now that kind of take that question for granted. Like, we see The Matrix and we're like, whoa.
Keanu hasn't aged. Is he a vampire?
Yes. But, like, that is a question that he was asking 50 years ago, 60 years ago. So he definitely was ahead of the curve. And our society is just so bonkers now in terms of technology, virtual reality, computers, robots, all that stuff.
Did you see the video of the robot opening the door?
Yes, I did.
Did it make you cry in fear? Because I literally started choking up. I was like, I don't like this. I don't like this at all.
It made me uncomfortable.
I was like, I'm going to grease all my doorknobs. Ain't no robots getting in here. Yeah. But those are questions that Dick explores in his works that we still don't have really good answers to. And that's what really, really good sci-fi or speculative fiction does, is it wrestles with the hard problems that face us today and the hard problems that face us in the future.
It forces us to imagine different scenarios. Mm-hmm. And that is a healthy exercise.
Oh, yeah. And so the cool thing about Philip K. Dick is how much that postmodernism, kind of dark, gritty, dirty techno future, also nods to some of the scary monsters of the past, right? Especially like vampires. I think that's why people love good old Phil as much as they do, is because he was willing to go there. Like, he was willing to imagine futures in ways that seemed so crazy at the time. Mm-hmm. And now we look at them and we're like, oh, yeah, okay, sure, we could see this happening.
Right.
Like, Philip K. Dick novels are not known for their utopias and hopeful visions of the far future. Yay!
I really dig that. I guess for so much of my life, and I think I was taught this, really. So many of us probably were, or we were trained to believe in some sort of myth of progress,
yes.
Right? That we were always moving forward and that with every single step, humanity was getting better and we were evolving and growing towards some sort of greater good. And suddenly there's this guy who's envisioning a future that's so bleak and decrepit that it makes us step back and say, like, oh, like, maybe we are regressing. The 20th century was the bloodiest of all. Like, what? Mm-hmm. Why do we believe that myth if there's absolutely no proof to back it up? Like, and like I said, I think that's an extremely healthy thing to do, is to ask your questions about whether or not the steps that you're taking are actually moving us forward or backward.
Right. And when does progress cease to be progress?
Mm-hmm.
Like, just because we can doesn't mean we should.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that a line from Jurassic Park?
It all comes back to Jurassic Park, doesn't it?
Honestly.
Maybe. I mean, that was definitely a Malcolm sentiment.
Daniel, correct us if we're wrong on that. But yeah, I think that's the difference between earlier sci-fi and this postmodern sci-fi, is this difference between a hopeful future and the ways in which science might make the world worse.
Right. And like romance, which we just talked about in our last episode, science fiction tends to be a genre and a lot of people dismiss it, or they don't think of it as something that is worthy of study or serious contemplation. So it's valuable when a writer suddenly takes something like that and proves, hey, no, pay attention. This can be truly good art.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what Philip K. Dick did.
So because we haven't read any Philip K. Dick before, we don't really know how to warn you guys. Like, maybe this is easy to read. Maybe it's not. Like, the one thing we can promise you is it's short. So it's got that going for it, which is nice. But we are as much in the dark on this one as you guys are, which is a really exciting place for us to be.
I'm giddy about it because I'm realizing how much I like this subject. I mean, we've talked about Westworld 1,000 times and how much you and I both love it, but how it also opens up so many philosophical, even theological questions. So I'm sure that that's going to happen in this book. So, you know, fans of Battlestar Galactica, fans of Westworld, Matrix type stuff. Like, we're probably, you're probably going to like this.
And we're ready for you guys to jump on board on this book and teach us some stuff.
Yeah.
Like, we know you're out there. We know you've got that knowledge. And we are ready for you to share it. So feel free to reach out to us on social media. You can find us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at Misfit Book Club. And we are there all the time and love interacting with you guys. And feel free to send us corrections to our email address at misfitbookclubpodcast@gmail.com.
Absolutely. And you can join us on Goodreads. Just search for Misfit Book Club. And once we get started reading, Maria is going to post some questions on Instagram for you guys to get involved with, which that's always really fun. I love to see people getting involved in those.
Yeah. And these questions are probably going to be pretty deep. Like, what obligations do we have to the robots we create? Like, should robots have rights?
Whoa.
I'm ready for those questions.
Oh, I'm not. I'm not prepared. We're going to be, though. That's why we read. That's why we read this stuff. We, you know, try to mentally prepare.
Oh, yeah. I, for one, can't wait for self-driving cars. God, I wish that were already here.
Oh, yeah.
Freaking hate driving.
It's fun to watch, like, Blade Runner now because it's 2019, right? When Blade Runner is taking place, which obviously we're on the cusp of that. And how much of the technology is so right, but then other of it is just so not right. Like
flying cars.
We don't Everybody's have them dream. Yet. The giant, like 20 story billboards, moving signs. Like we have that. We have way better telephone systems than the Blade Runner telephones.
Yeah, I think we're probably going to talk about the movie quite a bit. So y'all should just go rewatch it. And don't ask us which version, because there's like 70 virgins. There might be 70 versions. There's like 70 versions. Ridley Scott just can't stop tinkering with it. Mm-hmm. So there's like
director's cut, extended director's cut.
Mm-hmm. The actual release of the movie in studio. And I think that one actually had a much more hopeful ending because the studio was like, people aren't going to hate this if we don't offer them some hope. And then when Ridley Scott got a hold of it later, he like nixed that ending for the ending he really wanted. So the movie itself, it's hard to know like which Blade Runner is the real Blade Runner. Guys, it's like a metaphor.
So good already.
I can't wait.
I know it.
All right, guys. Well, I think we're so excited. We're going to start wrapping this episode up so we can get to it. Right, Pixie?
Yep. Sounds good. I'm really excited to hear what you guys think, too.
Awesome. So go ahead and subscribe and rate on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher Radio, or TuneIn. Ratings are super, super helpful for us because it helps more people find our podcast. I don't know.
All the things you do for the people that you love on the internet.
We hope you love us as much as we love you because we love you a lot.
We definitely do. All right, guys. Thanks for listening this week. Looking forward to hearing from you on our social media. And that's it, Misfits. Have a good week.
All right. Bye, guys.
Bye.